ready to move on here now with Mark 15, moving into verse 3. The chief priests continue to accuse him harshly. You've got a kai again, not translated. The verb kategoreo means exactly that. Kategoreo. Means to accuse or to reproach. A lot of verbal sinning obviously goes on through all of this, beginning with the chief priests and the Sanhedrin and all of that. And we'll continue up through, all the way through, in fact, the crucifixion. They were accusing him or reproaching him, in a legal sense, bringing charges against him. Him is Jesus. The chief priests, again, they're viewed in this as the ringleaders in all of this. They are accompanied, as we know, by the elders and scribes in verse 1. But they are clearly set forth as the subject. Then Pilate questioned him again, saying, "Do you not answer one thing? See how many charges they bring against you." And then harshly, actually, again, I skipped a verb, a word there. Polis, the adjective, means great, much, or many. They were accusing him of many things. charging him with many charges is the idea. And again, the whole idea of the mudslinging approach is throw enough at it and hopefully something will stick. And that's really their goal here. I mean, it's just one thing after another till they can hopefully get Pilate to convince that he just needs to kill this guy. Then is adversative weak, adversative duh here. Then, they've translated it in a continuative sense. But, or now, or then is fine. Pilatos, Pilate, his name in the Greek. Again, adverb Pauline, once more, or again. Indicating a second questioning, round of questioning. Questioned. As ep erotao, the verb we've seen repeatedly throughout here, interrogating him. Him is Jesus again, saying, by saying, it's a participle of means. By means of saying, do you not respond? Do you not answer? Is the negative u plus apokrinomai. Apokrinomai. Again, the root krino to judge from. It has the idea of formulating an answer in one's mind, considering the issues before he talks. But then obviously there's the verbal response. Do you not respond with one thing? By means of one word even. Accusative neuter singular. Do you not respond? Do you not answer one thing? One thing, i.e. any one of these charges? You don't respond to any of this? Behold, or look, pay attention. See is how they've translated here. It's the interjection, ide, which is normally seen in this phrase, or this form, edu. Look, see how many charges. Again, a passas here is an accusative neuter plural of the interrogative adjective. Again, the issue would be how much, how great, or how many, how much. See how many, is the way they've gone with it here, things they charge you with, essentially. Again, kategoreo, they are accusing you of, we might say. But Jesus made no further answer, so Pilate was amazed. But is again the weak adversative duh, the Jesus, ho Iesus, no longer or yet or again, uketi, O-U-K-E-T-I, uketi, used of time. When it's used of time, it means no longer or no more. Not one thing, literally, udice, the negative u plus the numeral heis, one. Not one thing, he responded, apokrinomai again. So that, you got here the conjunction hosta, which is used with an infinitive, and this is a pretty classic Greek construction for result. So that, as a result, Pilate marveled or was amazed. You got a present active infinitive, which is what hosta would take here, of thaumazo. T-H-A-U-M-A-Z-O. Thaumazo, to be amazed or astonished or impressed, even to be disturbed in some cases, by what one is seeing, to marvel. So Pilate, as a result of all this, Pilate's amazed. He's standing there, he's a little bit dumbfounded. He's like, I can't believe what's unfolding here before my eyes. Here you have this vociferous group of very hateful Jews, obviously wanting to kill this guy, and yet he doesn't defend himself. And this is not the normal behavior, again, of a criminal. Criminals would be much more vocal about their case. Because they know if Pilate condemns him to death, they're going to die and they can't change anything. So they've got nothing to lose at a certain point. A criminal has nothing to lose. Well, Jesus doesn't manifest this behavior. He just stands there and stoically takes it. Well, point one, following his private interview with Jesus, Pilate has come to the conclusion that Jesus was not a political threat and should be released. Two, he returns outside to address the crowd and announces to those present that he found no guilt in Jesus that would mandate the death penalty. Both Luke and John record that in their verses. I find no guilt in this man. Luke 23:4 there and John 18:38. Three, whatever strange ideas Jesus might have regarding royalty, kingdoms, and truth, whatever these were not sufficient to convince Pilate that he was a threat to Roman authority. There's no crime against having weird ideas. I mean, if we're going to kill people for that, well, where do you start? Everybody's got some weird ideas, probably. This is why, you know, the thinking of doctrine, clearing up your thinking with a divine viewpoint so that you don't think weird stuff. Well, you can't kill people for thinking weird stuff. Even if Jesus thinks he's the metaphysical Son of God and he has his eternal kingdom and all that. And he does. But that's still not ground to killing. Four, although the return from out inside the praetorium is only mentioned by John, the synoptic accounts resume the narrative with the fact that the chief priests and elders continue to lead the crowds in violent accusation against Jesus. And I say crowds because the word crowds is going to be used. I mean, as this goes on, over the course of time, more and more Jews are getting up and getting around that day. And they're coming out, maybe going to buy their Passover lamb. Who knows what all they're doing? They were supposed to have it bought on the 10th, but that doesn't guarantee that they did. And especially for people coming into the city. So this is going to attract some crowds just by its very nature. Again, trials and things like that. It's, you know, people seem to want to see it. God, how many courtroom shows are there on television? Not one of them will I watch. But how many of our, I mean, people are apparently fascinated with this kind of stupidity that you see on these shows. And it always seems to be like two idiots. And I guess that's more compelling television. Well, if I want to watch two idiots, me and Linda can get out of fellowship. We can do that at home. I don't need to watch TV for that. You know. So this is going to attract some people. You know, and then plus the chief priests are rabble rousers in this. The high priest, they're whatever crowds are out there are going to get stirred up and become a part of this. Now, are these Galilean crowds? Not likely. And, you know, and it's been said, and even I've said it, that the same people that cheered him into town on Monday were going to holler for his crucifixion on Friday. That's probably a bit of an oversimplification, because the people largely coming into Jerusalem would be visitors. They would be people from out of town. Many, many Galileans with whom Jesus was pretty popular. And Pilate knows this, and so do the Jews. The Jews know this. So for them to rile up the Galilean crowds against Jesus would have been a little more difficult to my thinking. But Judean crowds, I mean, there was this sort of fierce nationalism and also this sort of Judea's better than all the other provinces view because Jerusalem was there. So those people would be more inclined to not like Jesus. So, and again, could there have been people in the crowd Monday cheering that were here Friday accusing him? Sure, but I don't think they would have been in the majority. I don't think the Galileans would have wanted to see Jesus crucified necessarily. They knew how much good he had done. And they certainly knew he was not a political threat. I mean, they would have known that. Well, five, although none of the accounts provide the entire content of their accusation, it would seem that they were summarized by those three charges in Luke. That he misleads the people, that he forbids paying taxes, and that he's setting up this kingdom. Those would seem to be the crux of the three charges. Which, painted in that context, sound political. Sounds like Jesus is trying to establish some kingdom in opposition to Caesar. So six, the substance of their charges was that Jesus was a dangerous revolutionary who incited unrest among the populace. The implication was Jesus was inciting people to rebel against Roman government. And seven, the implication was that if Pilate did not address this matter, he would run the risk of an armed uprising among the Jews. Well, okay, so he has to deal with that now. That's a political issue. And certainly a military issue even now, if you're looking at an armed uprising. And he knew the Jews were pretty difficult to rule in the first place. And they were not above this sort of activity. He knows this about them. Well, 8, the verb kate gereo first means to speak against, but is used most often in the New Testament as a legal technical term for bringing charges against someone. The verb generally takes the genitive of the one being accused. In this case, him refers to Jesus. They were accusing him in verse 3. 9, the adjective polis, great, much, or many, is neuter, and refers to the number of accusations against Jesus rather than the mere repetition of a single charge. 10, the New American Standard has viewed the adjective as adverbial, which has the idea of many times, repeatedly, or harshly. And I think both are true here. I think this verb, this adjective probably serves double duty. I think they are accusing him of a lot of things, peripheral to all of these main charges. And also, they're accusing him in a tone of voice that's, you know, very, very strident, very harsh. They don't care for Jesus, and it's evident. 11, during the latter appearance, before Herod, Luke uses the verb eutanos, the adverb, to describe the action of the chief priests and scribes. This term refers to an expression of intense emotion and can be translated as vigorously or vehemently in Luke 23:10. That's how they've translated it in the New American Standard, vehemently. And I think the translation in Mark somewhat reflects sort of orientation to Luke's deal. That they viewed this adjective as adverbial because of Luke's account. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. 12, some of what they said may have been repetitions of the previous charges, like his claim to destroy the temple. Now, that would have been one of those peripheral charges that Pilate wouldn't have cared about necessarily. But if they paint him as a radical dissident who's trying to get people in an armed uprising, and he's threatened to damage buildings. And temples were regarded, even in the Roman, although they were polytheists, temples were regarded as sort of sacred territory. You weren't really allowed to mess with temples. Whatever you could do. And this was true of all their religions. You see that, for instance, if you look in the book of Acts, I think it's Acts 23, if I remember right. Nope, 22. Where are we at here? Nope, not there either. Grip, it must have been before that. Maybe Acts, nope, not there either. Okay, I'm going to find it now, just so I have to. Acts 19, there it is. I know it's in the book of Acts. If I just have to read the book, you just sit here and wait until I find it. No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't do that. Acts 19, verse 23. Now, about that time, there occurred a no small disturbance concerning the way. This was a title that early Christians were given based on Jesus' words, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And so the people who followed him were viewed as a part of the way. That was one of the terms applied to it. For there was a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines to Artemis, who was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. And he gathered together workmen of similar trades and said, "Men, you know that our prosperity depends on this business. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia." By the way, Artemis is also known as Diana. That's one of her other names. All of Asia, Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods at all. Well, that's a radical statement. You can make your own gods with your hands? Well, of course, that's just basic common sense. You can't make a god. But not only is there danger that this trade of ours falls into disrepute, I mean, we're God makers, man. We can't have him running around saying God makers aren't good. People will look down on us then. But also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she whom all Asia and the world worship will be dethroned from her magnificence. Well, if she's a goddess, how could she be dethroned? Good Lord. Gods are supposed to be transcendent. They're supposed to be above all this. But see, the whole point was anything that damaged or even sort of became a problem with a temple, even an idol temple, the Romans took seriously. And these, and of course, the people who were involved in the various religions of the world took it seriously, too. You can't just go in. That's why the Jews can't just go in and level that mosque on the Dome of the Rock, the Dome of the Rock there. But if God wants it out, it'll get taken out. Stray rocket from Syria, maybe. Who knows? If God wants it down, he can send an earthquake there and level the whole thing. If that thing is in the way of the temple going up. But see, there's some argument that the Dome of the Rock's really not where the temple's supposed to be anyway. That may not even ever really be an issue. And again, I don't concern myself too much about it until I see him start building. Then I'll think about it. Up until then, I mean, if I should see the temple going up, I'm going to say, oh boy, we're close. Ah, there's that fig tree restored. And so, but I, again, that's why I'm not so certain it'll happen in the church age, because any believer in the know would know then. But hopefully, again, believers would not, you know, misact up just because they knew the rapture was on the horizon. But there you see, in anything that even threatened the temple or the sanctity of a temple or even the workers that made their livings off of this were viewed in a very dim light. So for them to, on a peripheral charge, say Jesus is going to try to destroy this holy place, well, that would have gone along to bolster their case, but wasn't the primary charge they went with by any stretch. So again, some of these may have been repetitions of the previous charge, but are now recast in such a way as to suggest that Jesus had been inciting people to insurrection against the established authorities. 13, given the strong reaction of the leadership and those now assembled before the Bema seat, Pilate likely realizes that his desire to set Jesus free may lead to some riotous consequences. Now Pilate's got a little bit more of a mess on his hands. I mean, he didn't like this from the beginning. There's no love lost between him and the Jews. And he saw this whole case as problematic. Well, now it's getting worse. As the longer this goes on, the worse it gets from his perspective. Well, 14, giving his previous history with the Jews and knowing that there would be a transcript of the proceedings, Pilate was rightly cautious about how to proceed at this point. The last thing you wanted as a Roman government governor, and certainly to some extent even today among courtrooms, among judges, the last thing you want as a judge is your verdict overturned by a higher authority. And you certainly, as a judge, you really don't want people looking into your business very carefully if you're not all on the up and up. And the Pilate had, you know, had his own little skeletons in the closet, to be sure. And so he doesn't want Rome inspecting him too carefully. And plus, he had been associated with St. Johannes. This is a known fact. So Tiberius might not be too inclined to Pilate at this point. And he's already had to instruct him a couple of times about the Jews. And so this would be like three strikes, you're out. And Pilate's already got two. But so he doesn't really want this to proceed much further. I mean, he really doesn't. He's got a lot to lose. Well, 15, there is little doubt that Pilate had now realized that he was in a battle of wills with the Jewish leadership, who do not evidence any intention of compromising in the matter of Jesus. And 16, although Mark's account is very abbreviated, the fact that he mentions Pilate questioned Jesus again indicates that he was aware that Pilate had questioned him previously. It sounds like from verse 2 that this is just a continuation of the same moment, but it's not. Things have taken place in the interim that Mark doesn't record. There's been some back and forth, and you get more of that again out of John. So 17, throughout all these tumultuous accusations, Jesus maintained a quiet and resolute demeanor. This would have astonished Pilate, since this judge was more familiar with the normal response that criminals exhibited. 18, his rhetorical question, "Do you not answer?" is designed to draw attention to the fact that Jesus' behavior in the face of repeated and vehement accusations struck Pilate as something extraordinary. This was just not the norm. This was so far from the norm that it got Pilate's attention in a big way. That this Jesus somehow is different. Well, 19, the second question in verse 4 employs the interrogative adjective passos, which can be used to refer to degree, magnitude, or quantity. And 20, it was not just the number of charges they were leveling against Jesus, but the very serious nature of the charges that Pilate believed should have provoked a reaction from him. A normal person, even a normal person that was innocent, would have said something, you would think. Would say, hey, I'm innocent. None of this is true. Have them produce some witnesses. I mean, you know, what would you say if you were on trial for your life, assuming, you know, that it was God's will for you to defend yourself? Well, you know, what types of things would you bring up? I'd say, well, get them to get their witnesses in here against me. If they've got them, if they really exist. And when they couldn't produce any witnesses, well, Pilate would be back to the same place. Well, I got to let him go. He's innocent. But Jesus doesn't assert his own will. Jesus doesn't assert his innocence. He just stands there. And I think, and his demeanor, of course, speaks for itself. It does not speak of the demeanor of a guilty man. So, 21, Jesus' silence was obviously a fulfillment of prophecy. Isaiah 53:7, but is also a reflection of his belief that God possessed a very different view of him than the religious leaders did. Isaiah 53:7, in this passage, and a lot of the prophecies out of this suffering servant passage, Isaiah 53 is the classic chapter on the suffering servant. But in verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter and like a sheep that is silent before its shears, so he did not open his mouth. And this is a part, of course, now Jesus knows these prophecies. He knows that, you know, as he's walked in the will of God every day for his entire human existence, from the time he got old enough to realize who he was, and there had to be a point in Jesus' physical existence. He was born a baby. He wasn't born knowing who he was any more than you were born knowing who you were. So whatever age it is, you become self-conscious. You begin to, you know, formulate, you realize that you exist as a separate entity. You're not born knowing that. You're just born a screaming mess. And that's about it. And you don't know anything. People, oh, I remember being born. No, you don't. Good Lord. You were barely there and barely conscious. So, but the fact is, you're a brand new soul in this body. You have no idea what's going on. And so Jesus has to, as he grows up, he becomes conscious of who he is. By the time he's 12, he knows who he is. He's figured it out. I know who I am. I'm like, can you imagine this being 10, 11 years old? And you realize, hey, I'm the Son of God. And younger than that, probably, because, I mean, by the time I was 5 or 6, and maybe even a little before that, I remember being conscious of, you know, that I was alive and that I existed in this world. I didn't understand very much about it. But at some point, you become truly conscious. Well, Jesus had to do that, too. So he's known, and from that point, he's walked in the will of God every moment of his life. And so for him to stand here and take this, knowing it's the will of God, isn't in one sense that difficult. If you're convinced that it's the will of God for you to just keep your mouth shut, keeping your mouth shut is hard, though. When you got people standing there screaming at you, accusing you falsely and all manner of things, it's hard to not want to defend yourself. That is normal human response to this, I think. But Jesus knows the prophecy, and he also knows that God sees this all differently, and that God is the ultimate judge in all this, not Pilate. He knows what the will of God for his life is. He knows he's going to be crucified. So he just still has to stand there and bear witness to the truth. Well, 22, as Bamel has noted, the silence is the conclusion drawn and the posture adopted by one who had already invoked divine justice against the Sanhedrin and who is no longer willing to defend himself. That's out of a book called Jesus and the Politics of His Day. And 23, indeed, Jesus had committed his cause to the Father, accepting to drink the cup that had been decreed for him. This is what he prayed about in the garden. This is what he realized he had to do. He knew what was coming. He knows the full horror of it all. But he's reconciled to him. He's reconciled himself to this back in the garden. That was all. This was all settled in prayer hours before. And now, quite a few hours before, in fact, you know, probably 5 or 6 hours before, Jesus had determined. And when he tells Peter, put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? And this included all the sufferings that were going to be involved from that point on. And Jesus said, okay, I've got to submit myself to this because this is the will of God for my life. And so he stands there and recognizes that God's got all this under control. Also, 1 Peter 2:21-23. For you have been called for this purpose. Since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his steps. Oh, it's great that Jesus is really good, but now there's pressure on me to be like him. And so I have to exhibit the same sort of behaviors that he would exhibit. This is what Christian means, little Christ. It's a diminutive. And so everybody likes this idea of suffering, right? Where do I sign up? No, we don't like this. But it's not only been granted to us to believe on him, it's been granted us to suffer on his behalf. And so you're going to go through times in life. Who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. What's a normal human response? Tit for tat. Do something to me, I'll do something back. You get one of mine, I'll get one of yours. That's a normal human behavior. From the cosmic fleshly standpoint. And while suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And that's the secret to his success here. He just trusted God. He just faith rested it. He didn't try to extricate himself. He didn't try to do anything. He knew God would take care of all of this. Hebrews also 12:3-4. And what got him through all of this? Well, number one, his knowledge of doctrine, for one thing. His knowledge of the truth. But number two, he knew that the rewards that were coming to him for this are going to be extraordinary. In fact, they're going to be beyond what anybody ever has or will have in terms of reward. That he is going to not only inherit the greatest reputation of all time, but in fact, he will be the sole celebrity for the entire plan of God from now on out. That he's really the focal point of it all. Well, consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. See, people are going to withstand the truth. They're going to withstand your applications of the truth. They're going to withstand you standing for the truth. This is just the way the cosmic world is. This is the way the demonic world is. And what's not run by doctrine is being run by human viewpoint or doctrines of demons. Those are your options. Those are your three options. Either do things according to the will of God, according to the scriptures, or do it according to human viewpoint, the prevailing views of wisdom in the world. And we already know that the prevailing views of wisdom in the world were not of any consequence during the time of Christ. Paul says that in 1 Corinthians. Had the rulers of this age known what they were doing, they wouldn't have done what they did. He says the prevailing wisdom of the cosmos, by the wisdom of the cosmos did not come to know God. And so the cosmic wisdom is a complete failure. It's absolutely bankrupt. And then you've got the option of doctrines of demons. Do things the way the demons operate. And so you're going to withstand, you're going to face opposition in the angelic conflict. This is no big news, no new news. And Jesus did. But as he said, you have not resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against the sin nature, have you? The question being, no. How much have you really suffered because of doctrine? Well, our sufferings, whatever they may be, we have to admit that they pale in comparison to what Jesus went through. And he suffered under greater circumstances than ours. And he was absolutely innocent. We're not even always innocent. I mean, can you get up and say, there's no sin in my mouth, no deceit ever? You claim absolute perfection? I can't. No, I don't think anybody can. I mean, I know nobody is. But the whole point is, here he is perfect and he takes all this. And so we have, people are going to withstand the truth. You better know this going in. And the angelic conflict is heating up. And I mean, we're winding down in terms of where we are in terms of history. But as we wind down in the church age, evil is growing at an exponential rate. And in fact, evil to the point where God is forced to judge this world with the judgments of Daniel's 70th week. What you see in the book of Revelation. To where when he's finished, there's nothing left to speak of. All the mountains are collapsed. All the islands have sunk into the sea. And the world is a desolate place. Man is scarcer than pure gold. That must be some incredible evil. And you see that our country is the ringleader in a lot of this. Revelation 18, her sins have piled as high as the heavens. The things we do to provoke God, day after day after day. And guess what? God's not impressed. Well, here's Jesus. He knows what all has to happen. And yet he stands there and he's totally innocent and he takes all this. He just absorbs it under undeserved suffering, stays in fellowship. That's a challenge. And just lets it unfold in front of him. 24, additionally, there is no real reason for Jesus to respond to the Jews or Pilate, since both have evidenced the fact that they are not interested in the matter of the truth of the matters before them. They're not interested. He knows they're not interested. Pilate makes that arrogant statement. What is truth? Oh, well, we can't know anything about the truth. Is that what you're saying? Really? Is that your view? Nothing can be known? Really? And there are people like that. The idea, the word agnostic means exactly that. Nothing can be known. So they're just a bunch of know-nothings. Well, good for them. That's something to aspire to. I want to be a dummy. When I worked at Whataburger back when I was a kid. I was 18 or 19, somewhere in there. And even younger than that, 17. There was this one guy, and he was as dumb as a stump. I mean, just dumber than hell. And he walk around saying stuff like, dumb is where it's at. And he thought this was a mark of honor. And I'm thinking, even then, I was not even a believer at that point. And I thought, this is just stupid. This is just ignorant. This is retarded. And here's Pilate. What can we know about truth? Oh, nothing. Nothing can be known, really. So while agnostic is applied to those people who say, well, I don't know if there's a God or not, the word means they don't know anything. And they claim stupidity. Well, this is something to aspire to, really. I want to be as dumb as I can. Well, Jesus knows these are the types of people he's dealing with. They don't want the truth. They're not interested in the truth. They want to have their own opinion, and they want it to be justified. And guess what? It's not. Well, he knows they're not interested. A, the leadership of the Jews have evidenced their disregard of the truth during the illegal interrogation at the house of Caiaphas. They demonstrated that they had already determined a verdict and were merely seeking evidence to justify their desire to murder Jesus. We saw that in Mark 14:55. Pilate has demonstrated his disregard of the truth by virtue of his sneering and cynical response to Jesus' assertions about the reality of absolute truth. And see, this is one of the things. When I was an unbeliever, the thing that really got me was this concept of truth. I thought, well, truth must exist. I mean, there must be truth. Even as an unbeliever, I figured that much out. There must be truth. Truth must exist. And if the truth is of any value, well, it would have to be of supreme value. Because really, realistically, I mean, if people just don't care, they want to build their lives on any old thing, they can do that. But even then, as an unbeliever, I thought, oh yeah, I'd like to know what the truth is. The truth to me seemed to be pretty important. And it is. Because really, anything that's not built on the truth is built on lies. Or falsehoods, fantasies, myths, legends, whatever they build on, it's not truth. And so we're challenged with all of this. Well, Pilate says, what is truth? Well, what is it indeed? Do you really want to know? He didn't want to know. You know, and that was when Jesus should have uttered the line, you can't handle the truth. That would have been a good point for it. But see, he has to be quiet. He can't just do a good Jack Nicholson there. But that's the nature of the deal. Jesus has to stand here and just take all this. No defense. No. You guys do your worst. God is going to take care of me. And that's his view. Well, 25, at this point, the weakness of Pilate becomes evident. He has observed the situation and has drawn the proper conclusions about the motivations of the Sanhedrin, as well as the innocence of Jesus, but does not act in accord with what he knows to be just. He knows what's right, he just won't do it. How many people are there like that in the world? That's the majority of them. Even when they know what's right, they don't do it. We don't want to be among them. 26, Jesus' demeanor was such that Pilate was amazed. The Greek verb thaumazo conveys the idea of being extraordinarily impressed or even disturbed by something. 27, the verb can be used to denote admiration, as it does here. The fact that Pilate had made multiple attempts to release Jesus indicates that he was impressed with the contrast between Jesus' behavior and that of his accusers. And there's again, I can't remember where it is, but in one of the accounts, it comes out plainly that he knew that they were doing this. Oh, it's Mark. I'm sorry. We're going to get it in verse 10 of our chapter. I do know where it is. He was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. You know, and envy is to be distinguished in many ways from jealousy. Jealousy and envy are not the same thing. They're not necessarily synonyms. Envy is you want what somebody else has. And Jesus had popularity with the people. He had fame. He had all of this. And these people were despised. They knew that people did not like them. So they want what Jesus has. They want to be viewed like he's viewed. And that's envy. A jealousy is you can't have what I've got. It focuses more on what you already have that you don't want to share. You're jealous for it. So, he knows that they're envious. He knows what's going on. But he's really impressed with all of this. He sees Jesus handling all of this. And this is astonishing to him. He's never seen anything like this. And nor never would again. So 28, Pilate was experienced enough to recognize the charges against Jesus lacked foundation, in spite of the zealous and vehement manner in which they were presented. And 29, however, Roman justice did depend on the accused offering some defense to the charges against him. After 50 AD, enlightened officials would provide the accused three opportunities to provide to to respond rather to any charge that was made against them. They had three times they could reply, and then if they didn't do it, that was on them. But clearly here, Pilate gives Jesus every opportunity to defend himself. And he just won't do it because he's submitted to the will of God. And the will of God is for me not to defend myself in this case. It's for me not to vindicate myself. I have to stand here and take that. And that's an example that we're going to have to follow in our own personal lives. At some point in the angelic conflict, you'll be tested on this. Do you defend yourself when you're innocent? At some points, there's time for it, and then there's time not for it. So you have to kind of pray about it, think about it, figure out what God's will is. Well, 30, it is evident from the Bible that Pilate did question Jesus three times, offering him the opportunity to respond to the charges that the Jews had leveled against him. And from that perspective, Pilate's a good judge. He gives the guy a chance. He gives him three chances, in fact. But if Jesus is just not going to defend himself, Jesus paints Pilate into a corner, in a sense. Because as a judge, he's got to rule on this. And you're not defending yourself, so I'm presuming I have to presume you're guilty. And this gets into an interesting concept. What does silence say? And in the matter of law, silence says you're innocent. You have to in all enlightened legal cultures, we have the presumption of innocence. That you have to prove guilt. You can't just, and first you don't have to incriminate yourself. Even if you did commit a certain crime, we're not telling you to do that. You shouldn't commit crimes. But even if you did, you don't have to tell them you did it. You know, I don't know. You play dumb. You just don't have to say anything, in fact. So, in a large measure here, silence implies that he's innocent. He's not defending himself. But again, if you don't defend yourself, then what does the judge do? He's got no choice at a certain point. Well, 31, this behavior indicates that he was very liberal in offering Jesus the freedom to defend himself, which was likely motivated in part by his desire, that should be his lack of desire there, to cooperate with the Jewish leadership. But there's no love lost between these people. And they've already offended Pilate a couple of times, as we've seen. And he's not doing what they want, so they're getting more and more agitated. And you get these people, and they're in a battle of wills, and they're butting heads. And the longer they butt heads, the more Pilate just thinks, I want to butt heads with you forever. I don't care. You're not going to railroad me. But eventually he will cave to them, as we know. Well, 32, that you see in John 18 there, verses 33, 35, 37. However, when Jesus failed to respond to the charges against him, this would have resulted in a guilty verdict by default. Under the Roman system, if no defense was offered, Pilate had no legal option but to convict him. And 33, it is at this point in the proceedings between Mark 15:5 and 15:6 that someone mentioned the fact that Jesus had began his rebellious teachings, as they portrayed them, in Galilee. And so normally, when a trial was held in the Roman Empire, well, actually, that's in Luke 23:5 there. They said, he started all this in Galilee. Oops. They taught too much. They gave Pilate an out. They weren't smart enough. They got to run their mouths. They're gonna do this. And this is the insanity of people under the STA. They eventually end up trapping themselves with their own stupidity. It says in a Proverbs, do you see a man hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than him. So, they got a multitude of words here. Well, whoops, they slip and say the wrong one, Galilee. Uh-oh, this gives Pilate an out. So with that new bit of information, Pilate asked those assembled if Jesus was a citizen of the province of Galilee. And he just asked them straight out. When he heard it, he just says, is this guy a Galilean? Well, 35, normally when a trial was held in the Roman Empire, it was held in the province in which the offense had been committed. The forum delicti is what it's called legally. In 36, however, it could be referred to the province of which the accused was a citizen, the forum domicili. Thus, Jesus was technically a citizen of Galilee. He would have resided under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. In 37, the verb used for Pilate sending Jesus to Herod in verse 7. When he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also in Jerusalem at that time. Is ana pimpo, the verb there, to send up or send again, depending upon ana can have two meanings, the prefix there, the preposition. Ana can mean up or again. It depends kind of on the context of what you're doing. It can mean to send up, i.e., so he would be sending him up the legal ladder, we might say. But that's not the way it should be viewed here. Because Herod's no more powerful than Pilate is, in fact. They both are governors of their respective region. So it is used technically, although in one sense, in one case here, it is used technically for remanding a prisoner to the higher authority. In Acts 25:21, it's used that way. When Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I, ana pimpo, send him to Caesar. I.e. until I toss him up the next legal rung on the ladder. Which in this case was Rome. Because of Paul's appeal. Well, 38, however, it has been demonstrated that it is used in other judicial texts with a simpler meaning of to send. So the fact that the verb is not used technically is evident, since it is used when Pilate sends Jesus to Herod. And the same verb is used when Herod returns Jesus to Pilate. Well, they both can't be higher authorities. So, in this case, it should not be taken as kicking him up the legal ladder. That's how some interpreters want to take it here. But in Luke 23:11, and Herod, after he treated him with contempt and mocking him, sent him back to Pilate. Well, they both can't be higher authorities. One of them has to, you know, if one of them has more authority than the other one, then yes, but they don't. So again, it's not used technically here in a legal setting. In 39, this was merely an attempt on the part of Pilate to rid himself of a case that was rapidly becoming problematic and escalating in ways that seemed to have made Pilate uncomfortable. Well, yeah, he's got a real problem here. He's got these Jews wanting to kill this guy. He knows the guy's innocent. He knows they're motivated by envy. He's pronounced three times by this point, or will have pronounced that he's innocent, 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 not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. He knows that killing him is the wrong thing to do. He will try to, again, appease them by, well, let me just give him a good beating and send him on his way. You know, just give him an old-fashioned whooping and let's get him out of here. That's all. And maybe that'll satisfy these people. Well, they weren't going to be satisfied with that. So 40, additionally, Pilate recognized that Herod was not a Roman. and that he may have had some greater insight into the religious and political matters of the Jews. Now let's paint Pilate in the best picture possible here. Let's say he sends him to Herod because he thinks maybe Herod knows more. Maybe Herod can get to the bottom of this where he can't. And if that's the case, I don't think that is the case. I think he's just trying to get the case off of his docket. I think that's what he's doing. But he may have thought, well, Herod, is, as far as he would have been concerned, Herod was Jewish. Although Herod was not Jewish, he was Idumean. He was Edomite. And so as he kept his situation, you know, his palace was over there in what was ancient Edom in Perea of, at that time, that province of Perea, east of the Jordan there. So maybe Pilate just said, well, okay, he's more versed on Jewish deals. Maybe he can make some sense out of this that I'm not getting, because clearly here I'm not getting it. To me, this is an open and shut case. I mean, here's what Pilate knew. He knew Jesus is innocent. And that's it. I know he's innocent. But maybe there's something going on here that I don't quite understand, perhaps. Who knows what his motivation was. I think it was largely just to wash his hands of the deal. And in fact, later he will do that in a symbolic way. He will wash his hands of the whole deal. And say, I'm not involved in this. Well, unfortunately, he was. His name is on the death sentence, on the death certificate. He signed it. So, his name is on it. So, 41, although Herod was the ruler of Galilee and Perea, it appears that he would come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of the Jews. No doubt this was done in order to curry favor with the masses who tended to despise Herod based on his Idumean descent. Herod, none of the Herods were popular with the Jews because they weren't strictly Jews. And so they didn't like him. And they were always trying to fit in. This is why the temple, Herod the Great, had done this massive remodeling deal on the temple. That he'd been working on it for like 46 years. So that's a big deal. Why? To get the Jews to like him. And they still didn't like him. But of course the Herods were horrible, horrible people. That whole family was a bunch of idiots. And I mean, they were awful. They had the scruples of lab rats. And they might have been not that good. I mean, they were awful people. And you see some of their awfulness in this guy marrying his brother or his brother's wife, taking his brother's wife, Herod and Herodias. And so these are and they're awful people because we can't go do Acts. I've done Book of Acts. It's on file. You should be able, most of the notes are available for it. I think that was the book when I started using Word. So we've got most of those in Word files. But later on, when you get into some of the other Herods, I mean, they're awful. I mean, they have no problems with incest and other, you know, weird matters. These people were horrible. Well, so they're always trying to increase their popularity. If you know you're hated and you're despised and you're a ruler, there's something in human nature that people just generally don't want to be disliked. I don't, you know, what all they're willing to do to get people to like him is another issue. But typically, nobody likes walking around thinking, well, I don't want people to just despise me. But as a part of, you know, union with Christ, this is going to be our lot at some level in life. That we're not going to be accepted. Well, that's just the way it goes. So again, he wanted to curry favor. 42, Josephus does not identify which feast Herod attended. But he records the fact that he did go to Jerusalem with Vitellius during a Jewish festival. That's in Antiquities 18:122. 43, Pilate was only in Jerusalem to maintain the peace, while Herod was in Jerusalem for social and political gain. It has also been suggested that Herod came to Jerusalem due to the actions of Pilate at another feast. Luke 13:1 just mentions this in passing. And you know what? We'll have to look at this Tuesday. Our time is really gone. We'll look at that. But Pilate had pulled a stunt in Herod's territory or on some of Herod's citizens. And which, and this is part, I mean, we get, as you start putting this together, you get a little bit of why there was some animosity between Pilate and Herod. It's not, the Bible doesn't just spell it out. But you get that there's these incidents that occurred that they didn't like each other. And for good reason, as we'll find out. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.